You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Tone Zone.
Welcome to the Tone Zone. I am your host, Anthony Mullen, and this is a new type of episode I'm trying out. Obviously, I haven't been able to make consistent long episodes about single movies, kind of deep diving with multiple guests. My school schedule and, you know, networking a lot of people, it can get tough and it kind of falls to the wayside. So I'm trying this kind of short format, just me talking. I mean, later on, if this hopefully is successful, I'll have different kind of segments. I could bring in guests, have kind of more short conversations. But right now, I'm just consider this kind of a pilot episode. And I just want to talk about four movies that recently came out that I think are worth discussing. And I don't know if they would have warranted longer episodes. I mean, some of them may in the future. These are all four movies that I really love. And I just kind of want to share a spotlight to them. So, yeah, the movies I'll be talking about, like I said, they were all recently released, probably within the last 2 months. And what has kind of been the end of the year for movies really is things start getting into high gear with Oscar season, awards contenders. But especially this year where we've kind of been barren with so many quality movies, especially high-profile movies, really. It really has been a breath of fresh air to get these four movies and other movies that have been hits and that have been kind of the subject of a lot of discourse. So I'm talking about Todd Field's Tar, starring Cate Blanchett, Martin McDonagh's The Banshees of Inisherin, starring Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, James Gray's Armageddon Time, and finally, Steven Spielberg's new movie, The Fabelmans. So all of them kind of tie in together. I mean, they're the main quality that they all share is, in my opinion, I think they're really good movies. But I think so far, Tar has been the best movie I've seen this year. And before I start with Tar, I'm not gonna get into spoilers like I do with other episodes. I really want this to kind of be a platform to expose my viewers to new types of movies, to kind of get them thinking about the movies and eventually watching them, because at this time in the film industry, it's more important than ever to watch these new movies, especially in theaters. But yeah, all of these movies I did see in theaters. And yeah, Tar, first off, is I think it's the best movie of the year so far. I think that if I'm trying to encapsulate 2022 and the past 5 years kind of celebrity culture and the idea of how we raise up geniuses and then tear them down, sometimes rightfully so, Tar really is as good as you're going to get with that kind of movie. It is centered around this fictional maestro, this genius in the world of classical music, Lydia Tar, who is played brilliantly by Cate Blanchett, one of my favorite actors. I think you can make a very strong argument this is the best performance of her career, and that's saying a lot. She's got multiple Oscars. She is just one of the few major movie stars that consistently year after year makes interesting and really, really successful work. And she is at her apex here in Tar. She plays Lydia Tar, and Tar is a EGOT winner. She is heralded as a genius. She's not only technically skilled, but she's been kind of praised as that in both her circles and the public at large. And it really is a movie about it's a deconstruction of the genius myth that we are so obsessed with in our popular culture. There are so many people we hold up on pedestals and we look upon them for great information, but the reality is that many of them are human. And what I love so much about Tar is that it's kind of a piercing study on how exactly somebody becomes a genius, the sacrifices, the kind of, in Lydia Tar's case, the abuses you exert, the power, the abuse of power that you have when you're given this much praise, and how it perpetuates that myth through abuse of power. And I mean, it's really shown with an early scene that I don't want to spoil, but I think it might be the scene of the year. It takes place in a Juilliard class, and it's just, if you watch this scene, it is masterful on every level. It's a one shot. It's telling so much. It's got complex philosophical differences between the two main characters in that scene, and it really kind of sets the precedent for what the rest of the movie is going to be. What director Todd Field does in this movie is he creates such an exact, precise, but real world of classical music. It's a movie a lot about process. It takes place over Lydia Tarr's residency in Germany, and it's all about her trying to conduct a symphony, and it's all about the process and the kind of cracking down of her psyche that occurs during that. But that kind of chaos is only believable if you create a world on which the audience can really invest with the character. And this is a movie, like the other movies I'm going to be talking about, it kind of lives in states of gray. You're not supposed to outright hate Lydia Tarr, but it is very easy to root against her at times. But the movie does make you consider her point. And as the kind of dilemmas of the movie that she puts herself in come to the forefront, you get these complicated questions. You're not getting complicated answers, you're getting complicated questions. And I feel like that kind of ambiguity really helps these big movies about singular characters and kind of their dynamic with their supporting cast. And the supporting cast for Tarr is incredible. I think the two I want to just shout out is kind of a microcosm of just how well cast and how precise the environment that Lydia Tarr lives in is created. I think a lot of her problems come from her relationship with her partner, Sharon, who is played by Nina Haas, giving an absolute, like, nothing short of a brilliant performance, in my opinion. She's incredible. I think when the Oscars come around, I think it would be highway robbery if she was not nominated, in my opinion. I think she's really incredible, and she holds up a lot of this, of what this movie is asking. And also her assistant, who is always with her throughout the process of the concert, the preparations of the concert. And her assistant, Francesca, who is trying to kind of use her clout in Lydia Tarr's sphere to kind of socially climb. And there's a lot of dynamics that twist and turn within that. And that is, there are so many characters like that. It's got such a deep bench of gain character actors who are really providing to kind of the culminations that the movie brings up with Lydia Tarr. I think Lydia Tarr is a fascinating character. She's a, for those who don't know, I feel like this movie's been getting a little unfairly lumped in as a cancel culture movie. I think, obviously, if you watch it, there is a quote-unquote cancellation, but it's not really a hot-button movie in the way that I would consider, like, Don't Look Up. Don't Look Up is kind of a hot-button movie that feels like it's way too concerned about saying something important about very relevant kind of hot and button issues, as I've said. And what Tarr has that element for sure, but it's about other things. It's one of the pieces of the puzzle, but I feel like a lot of the promotion and kind of the discussions about Tarr is just like, oh, that's the cancel culture movie. I think there's a lot to be said about cancel culture in this movie, a lot that I agree with and a lot that I am complicated about, and I think that's the mark of a very provocative and interesting movie that stays in the culture. But it is really a testament to Cate Blanchett, how she plays Lydia Tarr and how she creates kind of a like I said, kind of a sympathetic but also kind of disgusting character. Like, you get moments of both, which I think is really interesting. And it's also a testament to director Todd Field. This is his first movie in 15 years, I believe. And, I mean, for background information, Todd Field was an actor for many years, and his most notable role was in Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. He plays Nick Nightingale. So a lot of his movies do get the Kubrickian comparison. Both of them work a lot in adaptation. This is not an adaptation of anything. Liotard is a completely fictional character. But I think there are parallels to Kubrick's work. If anybody's watched Stanley Kubrick's filmography, he specialized on creating the world, creating a believable world, a tactile world for the audience, and then bringing in chaos. So when that chaos comes and all the establishments of that world are broken and questioned and just torn to shreds, you believe it and you're compelled by it. I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's what makes like A Clockwork Orange or Barry Lyndon or Eyes Wide Shut, as I've said, really fascinating kind of worlds that you live in and things that really stay with you. That's why Kubrick films really stay with people. And Tar is absolutely that. It's got such a precise control, and it allows the audience to, at least for me and the people I was seeing the movie with, it was a small theater, but you can kind of get the vibe of how Tar was impacting people. Like, you really do get swept up in everything. And it's really, it's an epic that we needed this year in terms of just the lack of big scale epics with a prestige twinge. But also, it touches on a lot of the things we're seeing now with Elon Musk or insert name here. I feel like it really does question the people we put on pedestals. And I think it's an very, very valuable conversation to have. And it's got one of the great final scenes I've ever seen. And it just, I'm not going to spoil it, but it all gets paid off. And I was in my seat cackling by the end. It is incredible. I cannot recommend Tar enough. And I'm very interested to see how it plays for the Oscars, because I feel like on one hand, Blanchett might be a lock for best actress. I think Michelle Yeoh from Everything Everywhere All at Once is probably going to be the only contender, but I can see this movie getting just best actress or best director noms, and the Academy kind of straying away from picture or any other big nominations. But I think they're absolutely worth it. Right now it's my movie of the year. It's winning a lot of best picture awards outside of the Academy, so it's not that revolutionary of a take, but sometimes the cliches are right. So yeah, can't recommend Tar enough. Moving on, I think Banshees of Inisherin is an interesting jumping off point, because it is very personal for me in ways, but also not. It is Martin McDonagh, who is a renowned playwright. It's his first movie since winning Best Picture for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, a film that I'm not a big fan of. I think it has very uninspired filmmaking, and I can say that for most of McDonagh's work. But what makes it so special for me is that it was his reunion with Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. They had worked together for the 2008 cult classic at this point, In Bruges. And it's a personal favorite of mine. Colin Farrell is one of my favorite actors. I think he's incredible in Bruges. I think he works really well with McDonagh. And I think this is it's really hard to pick a favorite Colin Farrell performance, but this is, I'd have to say it's up there. Like, he's going to get Oscar recognition, but he is so great as the foil to Brendan Gleeson, who... It really is a two-hander between the two, Banshees of Inisherin. And there's also great supporting efforts by the rest of the cast. I'll get into them a little later, but I think the meat of this film is Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. The best way I can describe this movie is it's a breakup movie in terms of male friendship. And at least personally, I haven't really seen any movies about that. And I think it's a really interesting kind of topic to play with. The ideas of masculinity and men, especially Irish men, I think it's a very specific movie as well. It's a very specific movie, but it also feels dreamlike. It feels like a fable. They're living on a fictional island outside of Ireland during the Irish Civil War of the 1920s, but that's really just backdrop. It's not really like McDonough said that he really just included that to kind of increase the scale of it, but it really isn't what's important about this movie. It really is about the breakup between Gleason's character and Farrell's character. This isn't really a spoil. It's kind of the thing you see in trailers. It's their buddies who go to the pub all the time, but Brendan Gleeson just one day decides to cut Colin Farrell out of his life, and it's because he feels like he is wasting his life with what he believes are minimal pursuits in life, and he wants to pursue specifically songwriting, and he has this consistent pursuit of creating a song that will last. He's very obsessed with his legacy late in his life. And in contrast, Colin Farrell's character is very, you know, happy-go-lucky. He's a bit of a simpleton, but it's an interesting parallel because the whole conflict between the two is Colin Farrell is very happy with just being a nice man. Everybody believes him to be a nice man. And Gleason's cynicism that is the forefront of his character throughout the movie. He's really an agent of cynicism. I think it really drives an interesting narrative and dynamic between the two characters, but also it's an interesting conversation. There's one specific speech that I won't be spoiling, obviously, but it really gets at the heart of the dueling ideologies of these two friends. And it's really sad to see two people who were very close for many years kind of drift away and clash even at these differences at ways to live your life. Gleason is very much rooted in cynicism at this moment, and Farrell is very, very content with his life, just going to the pub and having good times with his friends. And it really does raise an interesting conversation of, like, what are our pursuits in life? What is a valuable life? What does it mean to be remembered? I think it raises a lot of interesting questions like that. And I think it's an evolution for McDonough visually. I think that he's really improved at capturing kind of the visual storytelling of a film. I think in it, the island of Inishirin is very well realized. You see a lot of beautiful sky scenery, and it's really, like the Irish Civil War, it is kind of just a backdrop. But for somebody who had really just been, like I said, I'm not a big fan of his filmmaking up until now, because it very much comes off as he makes movies to just as vehicles for his words to be out there. They feel very much like plays, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think this movie could be considered more of a play, but I do think the kind of vistas and the just the beauty of this fictional island that they were able to shoot. Like, he did an interview on personally one of my favorite podcasts, The Big Picture, and he was talking about all the consideration he went into with lighting certain indoor scenes. And it's that kind of attention to detail that I didn't really feel in Three Billboards or Seven Psychopaths or, those two movies especially. I think they feel like plays in the worst way. They feel, visually, I'm not a big fan of them. I there's no other way really to say it. But what makes Banshees really great, and it's the same reason why In Bruges is really great. McDonough's skill set is to make elemental stories that allow the actors to kind of breathe life into the characters. It's a very funny movie, same with In Bruges, but also it is dealing with these kind of sobering, cynical ideas. And you can make a comparison to Joel and Ethan Coen, but obviously I think Joel and Ethan Coen are visual masters. I think that's the big difference, but they're kind of playing in similar fields. But going to the supporting cast, Barry Keoghan is kind of the third. He's not the third lead, but he's like the first supporting actor, so he's kind of the third player. If you're thinking about it like a pitching rotation, he's the third. He's not one of the aces, but he's doing really good work. I mean, I've pretty much liked him in everything I've seen. Yes, including Eternals. I think he's the best part of Eternals, but I don't like his Joker, his little cameo in the Robert Pattinson Batman. I mean, that's not really a performance, but he is a scene stealer. He's been stealing scenes since Dunkirk, and he is really pitch perfect in this movie. He plays Dominic, who's kind of the town laughingstock, and his interactions with Farrell are very, very interesting. They allow both actors to really shine. Like, I think Farrell is pretty excellent in this, but he is really, really good with Dominic, Barry Keoghan's character. And Carrie Condon, who, if anybody's watched Better Call Saul, she is excellent in. I had no idea she was an Irish actress, but she is wonderful as Farrell's sister. And her relationship to kind of the themes of the story are an interesting parallel to the ways Brendan Gleeson's looking at his life. It's a very interesting juxtaposition, and both of them are excellent, and they're excellent in elemental, and there are aspects of the story where I feel like McDonough is kind of holding on to certain tenets of storytelling that feel a little contrived and unnecessary, but it feels like he is finally kind of evolving, or maybe even reverting back, maybe by going back to the formula that made In Bruges so great. He's allowing himself to kind of grow as a visual filmmaker. And this one pretty much knocked me out. I love this one. Yeah. I think a larger conversation could be had about Colin Farrell's chances as at the Oscars. I am certainly rooting for him, but I think it is going to be an interesting year. I've not seen The Whale yet, but I mean, everything I'm hearing about Brendan Fraser is pretty undeniable. Just a great guy. It's a great story. And although I'm not hearing wonderful things about The Whale, I'm hearing consistently good things about him. So I think he's pretty much a lock for a nomination, and I could see him winning very easily. And the thing that makes Farrell such a tough nomination is this is a very prickly work. It's very drenched in cynicism, and it would be hard for me to see the Academy giving Farrell the win, but I sure am rooting for him. But yeah, really enjoyed Banshees of Inisherin. It's one of my, I mean, I rank the movies as I see them each year, but I think, I can't remember, but I think it's like 7. It's around that range. It's very cream of the crop, but I was really, really pleased to see this movie really impact me in that way. So yeah, I highly recommend Banshees of Inisherin and all of Colin Farrell's 2022. He's in a renaissance. He's been in a renaissance for years, and you need to start paying attention to it. Moving on to James Gray's Armageddon Time. This is a very interesting one, and I feel like this is one that wasn't really promoted. At the scale of the movie, it is a prestige play. It's an Oscar play, but I think James Gray in particular, not many people would be familiar with his work, but he is one of my favorite directors working right now. His two most recent films, The Lost City of Z and Ad Astra, I think are such upper echelon kind of spectacle movies of the past like 10 years. They are visually gorgeous, but they all are in service of really, really consistent, precise and poignant themes of basically James Gray makes movies about people, usually men, but in some cases not, but mostly men, that must be said, kind of embarrassed of their feelings and feeling this compulsion to flee their situation. And his movies are kind of soaked in this regret and almost self-loathing, but that it was kind of it was just a matter of time before he kind of went inward and talked about a story from his own life. Armageddon Time is a it's semi-autobiographical, but it's basically just autobiographical about his time in 1980s New York as a kid and the kind of dilemmas that his family had to go through as a very secure Jewish family, but very, very insecure about their social stature and the kind of sacrifices and the kind of the moral injustices they were willing to do to kind of to move socially, really. And I'm not saying they do like awful things, but it is really just little things adding up. And it really is a, at least for me, it hit me as kind of a portrait of white privilege, where it's like there's so much that people wipe their hands off with that looking back, it can build such deep, deep inequality and injustice that for somebody like Gray, obviously he feels a massive regret for it, but he was just a kid. But there's a lot of the movie where he does play a role in it, and the entire movie is backdropped against the 1980 election, the Reagan Revolution, and I think it's an interesting, it does an interesting job kind of paralleling to how little things have changed within the political structure and the ideas of the American dream and what we're doing, willing to pursue that, and who we're willing to kind of topple to get to that dream. I think it's quietly a stacked cast. Anthony Hopkins plays his grandfather, who he is probably the most morally gray character in the film. Like, he is kind of painted as the lovable grandpa in many ways that he is, but there are so many little things that give you this kind of dissonance, but it's a dissonance that feels very real and rooted in kind of a not an insecurity, but kind of a fear. It's more of a fear of not blending in, not being assimilated. And it goes on with the people. So obviously it's semi-autobiographical. The names are changed. We're going to be talking about another movie where the names are changed for a biographical movie. But the Graffs, their last names are the Graffs. Banks Rapetta plays Paul Graff, who is just the analog for James Gray. He is fantastic. And his friend Johnny, who is the subject of many of these kind of injustices, is played by Jalen Webb. He plays Johnny. And like I said, with Hopkins, you get Jeremy Strong and Anne Hathaway playing the dad and mom respectively, and they are both really kind of in the pocket, utilizing what makes them both kind of such captivating actors. Strong brings such a kind of a self-loathing that if anybody watches Succession, you see that so constantly with his portrayal of Kendall Roy. And Anne Hathaway is really kind of really playing on like her recent string of movies where there's a lot bottled up, and there's a lot of kind of anxiety within her of her son's outcome, her family's outcome. And it really, like I said, it's really painted in shades of gray. There's a lot of, for like a pun not intended, I'm just now realizing, but the relationship between Paul and Johnny is really the heartbeat of the movie. And it is an interesting character study of who in their lives are willing to use it as kind of a pawn to get peace of mind of assimilation. And I think that it has very interesting questions. Like I said, these are really movies that don't give clear answers, all four of them. And I think that is, I think that's a real feature. I think the best kind of movies are provocative and ambiguous. They're not giving you clean, palatable answers, because that may be satisfying in the moment, but once you get to a certain point, you're not thinking about the movie. It's not gripping you in any way. And I think all four of these movies grip you in different ways. But I highly recommend this movie. It just is consistent James Gray excellence, in my opinion. I would also really highly recommend Lost City of Z and Ad Astra if you want kind of an adventure movie or a space movie, but a very, very different kind of space movie than we get, or a very different kind of adventure movie. They really are epics. That's the best way you can describe it. They're epics. And this one's a lot more, Armageddon Time's a lot smaller scale, but I think that it packs a similar punch, and I highly recommend this. I mean, as you can see, I mean, I'm just flowering praises to all these movies, and it's nice to talk about movies that you really like, and especially movies that they need the promotion. Now, it's very strange that this next movie needs promotion, but nobody's seeing it in theaters. It's about to go to VOD after 3 weeks in theaters, which is criminal in my opinion. It's Steven Spielberg's The Fablemans. Steven Spielberg personally is, and again, this is not a revolutionary opinion, he is one of the few directors that I am constantly enthralled with. He means quite a bit to me. I'm very emotional about Steven Spielberg. And this is his most personal movie. This is a semi-autobiographical movie, as I talked about with Armageddon Time, but it really talks about different things. It is at once a movie about a love of cinema, which personally I think that's a genre of movie that I'm very, very tired with, and I don't think it does much for me. There have been a lot of movies, the one coming to mind last year, Belfast. It was nominated for Best Picture. That movie did nothing for me. Later this year, there's going to be one, Empire of Light, that looks similarly like nothing. To be fair, I'm not the biggest fans of those two directors, but I was kind of a little worried about it being too kind of sentimental about film. And it is sentimental about film, The Fablemans is. But Spielberg is really tapping into some dark personal memories and some dark personal feelings that border on dreamlike states, which he's never really done, but it really is it's a movie about his family. They're renamed to the Fablemans, funny enough, and his father is played by Paul Dano. The great actor who recently most people had seen in The Batman. And his mother is played by the great Michelle Williams, who similarly, I think her last movie was Venom, Let There Be Carnage. But she is excellent at everything she's in. Get that bag for the Venom movies. But both of them, their dynamic is so fascinating, but it feels so specific to who his parents actually were. His father was a computer engineer, kind of at the forefront of Silicon Valley. It caused their family to move a lot, which plays a role in the conflicts of the film. And his mother is a very artistic soul, but feels very trapped and lost within kind of the confines of 1950s domesticity that was placed upon so many young women. And their dynamic is kind of, it really works because of their quote unquote uncle, the father's best friend, Benny, who is played by Seth Rogen. And Rogen is incredible in this movie. Just, I don't want to spoil anything, but he is incredible in this movie. And they have a whole interesting dynamic, and it really does. It kind of is. You get the family dynamics, but you also get these moments of Sammy Fableman, who is the analog to Steven Spielberg, learning process his emotions through film, but also hone his craft and kind of his love and hate cycle with the art of filmmaking. It is very interesting. It isn't just like a linear progression of like a child savant learning his craft and then he's the greatest filmmaker who ever lived. There are real ups and downs, and I mean, Spielberg is just one of the great directors ever. I mean, the sequences where he's like recreating his childhood films are just, it's magic. He hasn't lost a step throughout the decades. I mean, he's been making some of his best movies within the last 10 years, in my opinion. Last year, West Side Story came out, and I love that movie. That movie it's probably the best musical I've ever seen, just by the camera work and everything he's bringing to the table. It is just, I could go on about Spielberg for days and days and days. But Gabriel LaBelle plays the older version of Sammy Fableman, and I personally think that he should be nominated for Best Actor. I think he is incredible in this movie, and he has to, it is a long movie. It's 2.5 hours, and I think the last half of the movie is really held on to his performance, and it is just absolutely, like, I don't know, he was like in the 2017 Predator movie, but besides that, it really is kind of a first-time performance, and he blew me away. I think there's one small supporting player that knocked me away, Judd Hirsch. He comes in kind of halfway through the movie and has one of the best scenes in the entire movie. It is everything that I hope that this movie was going to be about, because it really does introduce very complex and tough ideas of the myth of Steven Spielberg. Because we as a culture, and this is an interesting kind of full circle moment with Tar, we raise Steven Spielberg up on a pedestal, in my opinion, rightfully so, but there is a lot of pain and confusion that comes within the craft that he was kind of destined to pursue, filmmaking. And it really is really interesting to see what Judd Hirsch talks about in that one scene. You'll know this scene. It's incredible. But what that kind of brings up, there are certain moments that kind of parallel back to that, back to what he was talking about in that scene, and it just creates such a full text that I think is, it's right now it's my second favorite movie of the year. I was profoundly overwhelmed by it for certain reasons. It hit very close to home, and I think that it's really sad that that basically all the movies I've talked about today were in theaters for about 3 weeks. And they were not really given much promotion, and they were basically just dumped onto streaming 3 weeks later. It's something that we're seeing in a much worse scenario with the release of Glass Onion, which Netflix is holding out a theatrical release besides the 1 week that it was out. And they're just kind of using it as a promotion to have people watch it on Netflix in a month, and I think that's just plainly, I think it's idiotic, because you are basically throwing the money away. The theatrical business model is unquestionably more lucrative, and especially it's more beneficial for kind of the below the line worker. The pay for movie stars throughout the last 20 years has just steadily decreased, and if you think Scarlett Johansson has to sue Disney for how she got screwed over for Black Widow going to streaming. Just imagine all the second unit people, the crafts and services. So much is impacted by kind of this I don't want to say uneducated, but kind of short-sighted preference towards just dumping things on streaming. You're diminishing the value of the product to the audience by just dumping it onto streaming. Like everything else, it just becomes that terrible word. It just becomes content. And we've seen throughout, like, this year, past years, everything since COVID, really, the movies that release in theaters, they have staying power on video and streaming. They are the most popular. Like, a terrible movie like Uncharted, I mean, I haven't seen it, but everything I've looked about looks terrible. That movie's done really well because, not just because Tom Holland's the star and that it's based off of a popular video game, it released in theaters and it did well. And a lot of movies benefit from that by being in theaters. The Northman, one of my favorite movies of the year, bombed in theaters. But because it was in theaters and because people were aware of it in theaters, they felt more compelled to watch it at home rather than pick your Netflix movie, pick your HBO Max day and date release. Like, the only HBO Max thing that was successful with that model was Dune, and everything else it's still baffling to this day that they're still committing to that. And I implore you to see any one of these movies, preferably all of them, I think they're all great, but seeing them in a theater is great. I feel bad for the people who didn't see Glass Onion, because those type of movies are really predicated on theater crowd experiences, but hopefully because all four of these movies were in theaters, they get that bump, and studio execs wise up and realize the money they are basically burning by not giving these movies platforms. But yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I'd be interested to hear in your thoughts of this kind of episode format. It is very easy for me to kind of get these out, and I do see a lot of movies every week. I'm trying to see new movies every week, so I would love to talk about them and promote them and kind of get people back to theaters. I think that's really the most important thing right now, to kind of keep promoting movies that I want to be made. And all four of these movies, I think, are just, they're the type of movies that I feel like need to be made. They're important for other different reasons, but I think they're all important in their own right. And I would love to experiment with this format in the future. Maybe have some guests on, as I said, to talk about new movies in a shorter format, or maybe doing like a mailbag. I don't know. This is a really exciting kind of new prospect for me, and I'm really glad to be back doing this. So, yeah, let me know if you guys go and see any of these movies. Have you seen these movies already? What did you think? And if there's any other movies you want me to talk about, please let me know. If you want to be on an episode, let me. I really appreciate you guys tuning in to listen about these four movies. So, yeah, have a nice one. Thanks for tuning in.